Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Michael and Patty Show, where we discuss everything Prince Edward Island real estate and PEI in one nutshell. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Michael.
Boy, it looks like a frigid wasteland here looking out at the waterfront in Charlottetown. I think you could probably walk across the Hillsborough River. Did you want to do that?
No, I wouldn't recommend anyone do it, but it does look like a complete sheet of ice all the way across.
Absolutely. Hard to believe we're on to episode 71 here. If you haven't listened to the show before, be sure to pause this episode now, go back to episode 1 and listen to all episodes 1 through 70.
Yes. Well, there's lots of good information, and it's not like it's a story that continues every week. They can even cherry pick the episodes that they want.
No, you don't want to do that. You want to listen to each one multiple times for stats purposes.
Okay.
If you do want more information, you can always find us on YouTube or newsletter, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, whatever. We're everywhere. Getting into it. I had a question for Patty last week because I always like to challenge her knowledge of the realtor code. And actually, I think this was in the bylaws, wasn't it?
Yes.
So this was in the Prince Edward Island Real Estate Association bylaws. What I asked her is if I, as a listing agent, have to inform other agents making offers on a property that they are in a multiple offer situation, which means they're not the only one making an offer. They actually have competition. And Patty responded, absolutely you do. And I said, I don't think so.
Well, and when you threw a question out at me like that, I would still say you should.
Should and have to are two different things.
I understand. It's within our rules and regulations. It does spell out what we are supposed to do if we were to find ourselves in a multiple offer situation. Do you want me to read the rule?
No, I'm going to read the rule.
Okay.
So essentially what this is supposed to do is give everybody a fair shot at the property. But in certain cases, there's some purchasers you just don't want to deal with that are dealing with purchasers' agents. So it would be nice if you could just not tell them that they're in a multiple offer situation, just quickly reject the offer to move along to the people that are serious. And that was the situation here. So the bylaw reads, unless it's been updated since, if the listing brokerage has more than one written offer to be presented, the following procedures shall be adhered to. And this is the important part. Unless otherwise instructed by the seller in writing, the listing broker shall, prior to any offer being presented, inform the other cooperating brokerages involved of the existence of other offers or counteroffers without disclosing their specific terms and conditions. I don't know why they had that. Without disclosing terms and conditions, because it has nothing to do with this bylaw. They also think the other thing they don't indicate is what if it's your own brokerage? They don't indicate that either. But the important part is they're saying if I have a written statement says I'm not to tell the other agents your multiple offers, I get that signed electronically or in person, I don't have to tell them, according to this.
It would be in the seller's best interest to not exercise this particular rule saying that they are instructing their listing agent to not advise the other buyers involved in this multiple offer situation of there being other offers. The whole premise of a multiple offer situation is to use the other offers, whether there's one or 10, as leverage to cause the buyers to put forth their best offer. When a buyer typically feels they're the only offer on the table, they try their best to negotiate a mutually agreeable contract, preferably in the buyer's favor. And that's what the offer put forth typically represents. However, when you're in a multiple offer situation and you have been advised that you're in a multiple offer situation, a lot of times a buyer will change their offer because they will pay more for a property. So that's what a multiple offer situation should be. And it is up to the realtor involved to properly advise the seller as to what they're allowed to do, what the expectation is, and what the process looks like and entails.
Oh, absolutely. But in a case where you're trying to move things along quickly, it can take time because you're going back to the other agents. You're saying you're in a multiple offer. Then they have a chance to sharpen their pencil, write another offer. And you know, based on the first offer they're written, if it was really, really bad and had a whole bunch of contingencies, like to sell a house and 10 other things, you probably don't want to deal with them. So that you can take advantage of this in the very rare instances where it's not advantageous to inform the other agent or agents that they're in multiples.
Yeah. And who sets, Michael, I know the answer to this, but who sets the time that the offers are to be left open until?
Who sets it? You'd have to define set. The purchaser's agent puts it within the contractual agreement that the offer's open till a certain date and time. If they're a smart purchaser's agent, they will talk to the listing agent to see that the vendors are around to have an offer presented and they're not on vacation or working or whatever the case may be. But ultimately, it comes down to whatever the purchaser decides to tell the purchaser's agent, or the purchaser's agent advises the purchaser to put that delineation in.
What I'm getting at is, if you are in a multiple offer situation, you cannot have five different buyers dictating what time their offer is being presented. So at that point in time, that's when a seller, and they're hopefully well-trained as a listing agent realtor, will end up advising them, we're going to hold off all offers until this time, which is agreeable to the seller, so that all buyers have an opportunity to submit an offer, and it is a positive, mutually agreeable time between the listing agent and the seller to review the contracts. Now, I have had, and the point I bring this forward is, I have had buyers' agents put forth an offer and say, my offer, even though all offers are to be held off until Thursday, my client wants this offer presented tonight at 6.
The bully offer.
That is called a bully offer, which is why I just wanted to make sure everybody, our listeners, were well advised. Bully offers don't get put forth any quicker or sooner than other offers. I've had agents try to do that. They don't win out. I well advise and educate my sellers on the onset of a listing right out of the gates that should we find ourselves in that situation, then they control the rules of the game. And I would have to notify all the other agents that may be submitting offers and letting them know that we've received a bully offer, to make sure that they all get fair opportunity, which this buyer's agent ended up pulling back and saying, that's fine, we'll be presented with the rest of them.
You could just go back to that agent and say, we're going to need you to extend this until the date and the time that the vendor has decided, or we can just reject the offer. It's your choice.
And that's,
you don't have to tell the other agents that a bully offer came in. We can just deal with that bully offer.
Oh, I understand that, but this agent was being very aggressive.
Well,
then
reject it and send it back. And you know what I like to do? I like to call them in person and personally congratulate them on the rejected offer.
And that's what I advised them, is that my client will be inclined to reject this offer out of fairness and the rules that we've laid out. So therefore, if your client does want to submit another offer to be presented at presentation, please know my client is now going to know which buyer in this pile was the bully offer, trying to negotiate a deal, undermining everyone else and not playing the game fair.
On to our next trick question.
Okay.
And this question seems simple, but when you really think about it, primarily as far as capital gains and tax purposes, it unfolds into something that's pretty complicated and probably something you'd want to talk to your accountant about. And the question is, what can you do when you inherit a house? Assuming it's paid for, there's no liens or mortgage on it. It's paid for, it's clear. Someone phones you up, grandpa's died, you own a house. What do you do with that house? We're going to assume, to make it more complicated, it's in another province a couple thousand kilometers away. It's not down the street.
Yeah, so if it's not in your same province, it has to go through the whole probate process.
Forget about that. We've gone through all that. Okay. You own the house. It's paid for. You've gone through probate. Or, more importantly, and this is an interesting point, to save yourself from having to go through a lengthy probate process, if you know you're going to inherit this house, talk to your lawyers and make sure you're on the deed. And then you have a, I'm just trying to think of what it's called, basically means that if the other owner dies, the house is conveyed to you.
Joint tenancy.
Joint tenancy, but with the right of survivorship, I think is what it's called. Talk to a lawyer. We're not lawyers. getting to the original question, what do you do with that house when you inherit it? Well, the obvious thing is you can sell it, right?
Correct.
What are your capital gains if you sell it, typically?
Based on the day that...
You sell it the day you get it. Grandpa's dead, you put the for sale sign out front, and tomorrow it's sold. Thanks, Grandpa. Your capital gain should basically be nothing. Again, can talk to your accountant, but when you inherit this house, probably one of the most important things you should do, so you don't have to do a retroactive appraisal, is get an appraisal done when you inherit it to establish a baseline. And if you're smart, you'll tell that appraiser to give you a higher number than a lower number, providing they have the data set and have that ability to put a bigger number on it. Because down the road, you're going to pay capital gains, from what I understand, on what you sell it for in reference to what you inherited it at in the form of an appraised value. And it's a lot easier to appraise a house today than phoning up an appraiser 20 years from now to appraise a house that sold you inherited 2 decades ago, right?
Yeah, it would. Because
the data may not even be there either.
Correct. It would make perfect sense to appraise it at that time, so it's time stamped and you just store it away instead of trying to. And I've had clients request, because CRA needed that from them, could you do an appraisal or an evaluation? They would accept one from a realtor, you know, CMAing this property, giving an approximate value from 12 years ago, which is challenging to do.
Because you know the market today, you can't memorize every single year in the past 20 years. So the pros to selling the house is quick access to cash, avoid ongoing maintenance and property tax costs. Cons, capital gains tax may apply. Market conditions could impact sale price. And there's a bunch of other stuff here. I did a bunch of research. It's 3 pages long, but we're not going to get into everything. Other thing you can do is what?
The renting it out.
You can rent it out. And then you can come back and find your house completely destroyed. Because most people don't know how to interview potential tenants. If you're going to rent it out, my suggestion is get a good property manager to handle the rental, the leases, which are probably the most important part, and do background checks, credit reports, financial statements, everything.
And if you're new to the rental business, understand the Landlords and Tenants Act. What are your rules as a landlord, and what rights do the tenants
have? Property management.
I realize that, but I do still feel that they should be educated. They should take the time to educate themselves so they know what questions to ask a property management company to make sure they're hiring a good one as well.
Oh, absolutely. And where do you find a property management company? I know. Don't I just go to Ask PEI and put it out there in an open question and get 400 answers?
No, I wouldn't advise that.
Do what I ask.
Well,
an experienced real estate agent.
An experienced real estate agent, for sure.
Or experienced real estate lawyer or real estate accountant. Someone that's a professional, that's in the business, that's dealt with all these property management companies and know who does the best job. The other thing I can do is move into it. Now, if I move into it, I could potentially become a resident of that state or province. The pros, no need to pay rent or mortgage. Cons, property taxes, maintenance, and insurance costs.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Makes complete sense.
I'll let you do the next one.
Well, you could renovate and flip it as well, depending if it is grandma and grandpa's house and it's very dated and they still have the 70s carpet. And
people love pink carpet.
We've seen everything from carpets all the way up the side of the bathtubs in some of these older homes. So to renovate and flip it, you just want to make sure you don't just put lipstick on a pig. You actually take the time to do everything right. I mean, you could do that essentially and try to get top dollar, but sometimes your name and your reputation, I wouldn't want someone to come in and realize I just did a slap-up job on something.
So the pros potentially increases the value of the property for a higher resale price. Again, talk to your agent to see if you're in a location and you're in a market that would be beneficial from a renovation. The best type of house to do a renovation that I can think of just offhand would be the crappiest house in the best neighborhood.
And I was going to say that, and make sure whatever money you're looking to put in, you would be able to, get out of that property and you don't overdevelop or over renovate.
It's a good thing my father's not listening to this podcast because I'm just picturing his house right now. So if you've inherited the crappiest house in the best neighborhood, chances are you have more latitude to do renovations to increase the value. Whereas if you have the best house in the worst neighborhood, real estate's all about location, location, location. All the renovations in the world is not going to change the location on that house. So what I'd probably do is talk to your real estate agent and or real estate appraisers to even do a preemptive CMA, comprehensive market analysis, or appraisal of what that property is going to be worth after the proposed renovations are done.
Correct.
Good. And the cons requires investment up front, market risk, renovation timelines.
Yeah, sometimes even finding contractors to do the work can take time. So you're carrying the property. And yes, being able to have the capital up front to go ahead and invest into this property would definitely not everybody is in that financial position. And then the market, how long it may take to actually end up selling it.
I wouldn't hire anyone to do the work. I just watch a bunch of YouTube videos and become an overnight expert.
Of course you would.
You could use it for a home equity loan. So the way this is phrased, I would probably phrase it differently. But essentially, now you have an asset. Let's assume that house is worth $1 million. It's paid for. This is one thing I would consider doing. I would pull all the equity out, which is probably up to a maximum of around 80%, maybe more. Take it out and use that money, that $800,000, as a down payment on a larger apartment building. And then I would rent the house out and I would rent the apartments out to generate a revenue stream and preferably do it through a property management firm.
Sounds like a good plan.
So I can wash my hands of it because I'm not going to be able to manage properties that are potentially 2,000 kilometers away.
Yeah, and now is this inheritance, this home that you've inherited, has now created a revenue stream for you.
Right. So what they're saying is they're saying take out a home equity loan, which is the same idea. It's exactly the same thing. Access to cash without selling. Funds can be used for other investments or expenses, or you could just take it to Vegas and roll it on roulette table.
Oh, is that would that be an
You
option?
could triple your money.
Or you could lose all of it as well.
And then they say the cons adds debt. And interest costs, which brings us back to the argument of good debt and bad debt. Good debt would be debt you would use to buy businesses or apartment buildings or anything that provides an income or even other investments. If you can take $1 million, you get a 6% and get a return of 20, it's good debt. But if it's bad debt, like if you're planning on buying, I don't know, 10 big screen TVs for home, that's bad debt. Any depreciating assets, cars in most cases, bad debt. Boats, bad debt. So if you use it to actually create an income stream, it's good debt. Make sense?
Makes complete sense.
Here's one of your favorites. Gift or transfer it to a family member. And I'm going to add here, even though it's not in our notes, a charity. For instance, the Prince Edward Island Humane Society would be number one on that list.
Yes, and I've had clients also gift their homes because they didn't have any children to their local church or, like you said, the Humane Society. So if there's a cause or something that you believe in,
Foundation. We
some
had
sort
one
of
give it to a
foundation.
foundation.
Yes. So that does happen. If you don't know anyone that ever did, just know that stuff, that generosity that we have here in Canada, that is always an option for you if you're wondering what to do with your real estate and if you're planning your will.
So the pros helps a family member, or in this case, a charity, potential estate planning benefits. Cons, and this is something a lot of people don't look at. I always look at it first, potential tax implications. Again, talk to your accountant.
The first thing that comes to my mind on this
Yes,
is
I do.
what is
I have
it?
no idea.
Two and a Half Men, where Charlie Allen wanted
Oh, the
the
house.
condo, not
It
realizing
was the waterfront house in
that,
Malibu.
yes, and not realizing how much it was going to end up costing him in property taxes, which he exceeded his income. So therefore, inheriting Charlie's home was not a plus for him. In fact, it stressed him right out.
I remember that episode because the property taxes were about $200,000 a year.
Yes.
They bring up use inherited house as collateral for new mortgage or investment. Yeah, you could do that too. You go out and buy yourself a bigger house. It's a tool. And we did sort of address this, but we're going to talk about this just quickly. Have a residence in that province. If there are tax benefits to being in that province, you may want to move there. If you don't need to work in the current province or state that you're in, and make that your new home and benefit from those tax benefits in that province.
Yeah, or an opportunity to maybe move back if you were. It's hard when you move out of certain cities and that, and their markets continue to take off, and you maybe moved into an area where they didn't see as much market increase and growth. And then to try to re-enter back into some of these communities would be virtually impossible for some. So this would allow for an opportunity to do that.
Somebody told me many years ago that home will always be home. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. I haven't moved home. Tax implications to consider in Canada and in closing, capital gains, probate fees, property taxes, all of these things should be considered, probably mainly the capital gains, the probate fees. On to our next question. Oh, the old penny wise and pound foolish. How many times have we ran across this in the last few weeks? People that are reluctant to use a lawyer or an accountant or a property manager because all they can see is, oh, I'm going to have to pay that lawyer, or oh, I'm going to have to pay that accountant or property manager. Meanwhile, back at the farm, because of this poorly designed decision, that lawyer letter, that involvement with a lawyer could have saved you tens of thousands of dollars in grief if it would have been handled properly by your lawyer. For instance, you're evicting a tenant. Tenants have a lot of rights in Prince Edward Island and in many states and provinces, and these things are usually best handled by lawyers, specifically when you have tenants that don't want to move out.
Oh, absolutely. And you need to know, again, back to, you need to know what your rights are on as a landlord, as well as your rights as a tenant, or what you could end up receiving from the tenant, because if they're well educated and know their rights. So representation of, again, a professional lawyer that deals with real estate, home inspectors, having a realtor. I mean, the one person that I can think of that is a private sale individual, a seller who tries to do all of this on their own, and then unfortunately an uneducated buyer who enters into this transaction and they have no idea what they're doing. So to have representation, if you're going to be a landlord and you've ran into situations, or if you're going to be purchasing a property, like you said, penny wise and pound foolish, you may be losing so much money. You're looking at what it's going to cost you instead of what you're going to gain by having a professional representing you.
And that goes the same in real estate with these for sale by owners that have this short-sightedness that, oh, we're going to save the commission. Look at us. We're going to save 25 grand. And then they sell the house for 100 grand under market.
Yes.
Makes perfect sense, but they can brag to their neighbors. And you know what they'll always do? They'll always tell the neighbors the house sold for more than it did.
Oh, we've actually encountered that many times during listing appointments where a seller will say, well, I know so-and-so's house down the street sold for this, or they told me they've got that. And I've pulled up on GeoLink, our provincial government site, and showed them that is not what that property sold for. This is what it sold for, not to, you know, affect or impact your relationship with this individual. However, they've misrepresented their number to you.
Good business people are smart enough to have good lawyers, accountants, real estate agents, appraisers, contractors around them. They don't try to cut corners to think they're saving a nickel and spend $100. Next, storing furniture. This was another one we ran into with a rental unit and an agent that, what happened? She went to list her house and the agent told her to take all the furniture out and put it in storage. Well, that turned out well.
Yeah, it wasn't a good situation. If your realtor is telling you it would be best to take all your belongings and stick them in a storage facility, or if your seller is asking, we can do this, I wouldn't recommend allowing that seller to do that. I mean, if they have too much furniture and it's about thinning it out and it's for a, you know, certain period of time, But this went into a couple of years, and unfortunately, this furniture has had mold and, you know, rodents, and because it's being stored outside, and it's quite unfortunate because there's some, it was really nice stuff, nice furniture. So they've been, in my opinion, misinformed.
If you're going to store your stuff, and this accounts for cars too, including my car that was infested with mice.
Yes.
But now they've got another home.
Yes.
In heaven.
Sure.
Store your stuff in a heated, air-conditioned storage facility. And there is at least one in Charlottetown that I know of, and I know there's others being built.
And it's a great facility, that indoor storage with the heat. And I mean, I know there's others, but I've gotten a tour of that a couple weeks ago. And, you know, for the cost, to be able to preserve your belongings, your content, it's well worth the money.
That's why I mentioned just a few months ago that would be a great place for your son to get an apartment.
Get moving along.
It would be cheap. Where is he going to find an apartment for $300 or $400 a month? Sure, it doesn't have windows. Brokers not providing training to their agents. I don't think I've ever seen so many offers poorly written than I have in the last couple of years since we've gone from 200 to 500 plus agents. I look at this situation and I say to myself, well, what does it take to become a real estate broker so I can have agents? Basically, a broker can become a broker with zero transactions and 0 days as a real estate agent, even though they like you to believe you're supposed to be in it for 2 years, but they never mention transactions, experience, and training. I also look at what brokerages these agents are from, and then I look at the brokers' sales to see if they're active in the market. In some cases, the broker's never sold a single property ever, and now they're giving out zero experience knowledge to their agents. And then you've got other brokers which are in the top 10 agents, which are more focused on filling their own pockets than they are on training their agents so they can represent the firm better. Thoughts?
Yeah, so I feel the point in this, again, if as our listeners, if you are a buyer or a seller, you want to, this could cost you money not hiring somebody that has the training and the expertise. And it's okay to ask, what credentials do you have aside from saying you are a realtor? Because many brokerages do not provide additional training. They just, and if they do, it's little in-house, you know, sessions and that, where they're talking
about a website.
Yeah, website or Excel spreadsheet, or they go over the rules, or if they do cover GeoLink, and FinTrack is another one that we're required to do some in-house training for as a brokerage responsibility. However, the offers, and I know the offers that you were referring to and offers that we've received, one of the offers that we received, the agent, because it was so poorly written, Michael, that they didn't even acknowledge their brokerage was representing the buyer. They put my brokerage as representing the seller and the buyer, which then ends up, they don't get compensated. I mean, we're honest people, but they wouldn't get compensated. In this particular offer that was really poorly written, the agent said they had their broker approve it, which was also very concerning.
But a broker that's never sold a single property ever, that's in the business of having as many agents as possible.
I think people feel, I think in our industry, to be able to, it's like a peacock syndrome. You know, you're fluffing up your feathers and you look really majestic and cool because you've got X amount of realtors on your team. I'm of the belief, whether I'm right or wrong, but I'm of the belief that I would rather have a smaller team, which I do, but a highly educated team that I spend my time, you know, behind, educating, promoting, always available, you know, to them, making sure that if they do have questions, they have the cohesiveness of our team to be able to, I'm in this situation, I need some help, I need this contract, I don't know how to write this clause. That just better protects the consumer, which is what we're in the business of, is providing real estate experience and a real estate service.
If a broker spends more time educating their agents. That brokerage, even with 5 or 6 or 7 top producing agents, will outsell that brokerage that has 60, 70, 8,500 agents that are doing nothing or inexperienced. If you're hiring an agent, we've said this in other podcasts, hire an expert. An expert, someone with 10,000 hours of experience, which equates to about 5 years full time, 40 hours a week, and has 1,000 transactions, 1,000 transactions. That's the same thing they apply to appraisers. They have to do 1,000 transactions before they get their stamp.
Yeah. And if you are a realtor, I'll just let you know because I see a lot of violations of this. Take the trademark law. There's so many cases where people are violating and they're not using the realtor trademark properly, even in their email signatures. You should be doing a complete audit of everywhere that you've used the realtor trademark and make sure that you're adhering to the trademark law, as well as, so we always take, all my agents take their trademark law. It also helps me not have to police them as much because they're self-policing. They understand what the rule is and the code of ethics, which does get offered or a mandatory course every other year or so within our association. But I do feel, what is your responsibility? What should you be doing as a realtor to represent your clients out there? So if you're not in a brokerage that gives you a lot of additional courses, those would be the two that I would be recommending.
And then leave that brokerage.
I'm not saying anything like that.
I think they should leave. Charging people in other locations in the world more money for your property because you think they're stupid. And this isn't something we do. This is something owners do. They figure, well, if you advertise it in China, they're going to pay more, the states. And the other thing we're seeing, well, it's a different subject, is tax evasion, where they're selling a property, say, for $500,000, but they're putting it in the books as $250,000, and then they're paying $250,000 in cash difference. Number one, purchasers are educated. They know what properties are worth. If they don't, they can ask the agent or get it appraised. As far as avoiding taxes or property taxes or capital gains taxes by saying, oh, here, we'll sell it to you for $500,000. We're going to say it sold for $100,000 and you're going to give me a check for $400,000 separately. That runs into so many different problems from a capital gains or even a criminal law aspect that you don't want to do it. Honesty is the best policy.
Yeah. And it's our tax system here in Canada. Not that I'm saying they're allocating everything properly. I'm not even going to get into that. But that's what pays for, you know, our teachers and our police and our healthcare system. So to avoid paying taxes, it's just part of our responsibility as Canadians to do our fair share.
Report your sale amount honestly. Do not misrepresent prices to other locations in the world thinking they're stupid and they're going to pay more because they're probably not. And that's about it. I think we can close it down. It's been our usual disorganized podcast.
No, actually, I think we covered a lot of really good topics, not too many to overwhelm. And I mean, it could easily be re-listened to if you wanted to go back and take some notes and
figure out what we said.
No. Well, thanks for listening to the Michael and Patty Show, otherwise known as MAPS, the Prince Edward Island podcast that helps guide and navigate you through the buying and selling process, as well as anything in extra Prince Edward Island that we end up going on little rabbit trails and covering during our conversations and discussions every week.
I think in all fairness to you, you're a little preoccupied because you're watching this little baby sea otter bob around in front of us.
There was a sea otter during our...
About a foot long.
Yeah, and it was so cute. And he was like sliding around on the ice and going up and down one of these little holes, I guess, that is in the ice. So I did stay focused, but it was really cute. Just another benefit and wonderful thing about living on Prince Edward Island. And you never know what's going to happen while we're doing these episodes.
Everybody, thanks for listening. Be sure to follow, subscribe, give us a star rating, feedback. If you have any questions about PEI or PEI real estate, just email it, text us, Twitter it, and we'll get it answered for you. Have a great day.
Have a great day.